Good morning. I called today the State and Local Government Finance and Policy Committee to order for Tuesday, February 28th. A quorum is present. Lead Nash, would you like to move the approval of the minutes for February 21st?
Madam Chair, I don't know that I'm able to.
Oh, that's great. Sorry, I forgot about that. You were. That is exactly right.
Senator Newton might want to.
Well, let's call him Representative.
Old habits, Madam Chair. Old habits.
I'm so glad you caught my error, Representative Nash. Representative
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to move the minutes of Tuesday, February 21st.
Thank you. Representative Newton moves approval of the minutes for February 21st, 2023. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor of adoption, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Seeing none, the motion prevails and the minutes for February 21st, 2023 are adopted. Representative Nelson, it's very good to see you here this morning. You have our first bill on the agenda this morning, House File 1695. Since you are not a member of this committee any longer, I will move that House File 1695 be re-referred to Human Services Policy Committee. Would you like to discuss your bill?
And Madam Chair, if you look on page or line 1.7, there's a blank there.
Yep.
We need to fill in that date. The date is yesterday. It was submitted to the LCC, so it should be February 27th, 2023, and I believe you can do that as an oral motion.
Thank you very much. I will move an oral amendment to insert February 27th, 2023. Mr. Gehring, would you please state the official amendment that we would be voting on?
Madam Chair, members, so the amendment would be page 1, line 7, delete the blank line and insert February 27, 2023.
Is there any discussion? All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? The oral amendment is adopted. Chair Nelson, to your bill as amended.
Madam Chair, as you can see, it's a very small bill, but it's a very important bill. This is a bill that ratifies the recently agreed upon contract between the state of Minnesota, the SEIU our healthcare union, which covers the self-directed home care workers, which are commonly called as personal care attendants. The contract will be funded in a different bill, which is due shortly from the revisers, and will be heard in the Health and Human Services Finance Committee. The funding language will be carried in the governor's budget, and the members voted to ratify this bill last week. And yesterday, MMB submitted the contract to the Legislative Coordination Committee, a subcommittee for employee relations. This contract covers approximately 2,900 workers in three self-directed home care programs. That includes the PCA Choice program, which clients qualify for hours of service in two budget programs. The Medicaid-funded consumer-directed community supports program, and the state-only funded consumer support grants program. These programs are self-directed where the clients recruits, trains, and supervises the workers. The agency serves as a fiscal entity to process the payroll, and the contract does not apply to the workers from traditional or agency PCA programs. In this program, the agency hires, trains, and supervises the workers on behalf of the client. Again, these are the self-directed by the clients themselves. Those workers work in the private sector employees and are employees of the agency. I should note, however, that while workers are not covered by the contract, the agencies will receive the same rate increase without the same requirement to pass the funding along to the workers. Since they gain the right to form a union, this will be the fifth contract. Every time we have made progress, but this contract stands out as a game changer. The contract raises the minimum hourly wages from $15.25 an hour to $19 an hour in January, and next year, and $20 an hour in January of the year after. Higher wages will help fight the enormous workforce shortage we face in the home care industry. We currently face over 10,000 unfilled home care positions in Minnesota, and I am sure that you have all seen the horrific tales of disabled clients suffering or even dying in their homes because they were unable to find caregivers. For the first time, we have a contract that will allow us to make a real dent in the workforce shortage. We will no longer keep pace with the market. Now we will get ahead of the market and attract the workforce we need. These workers, predominantly men, are women and people of color, have been essential workers during the COVID-19 pandemic. They stood by their clients during the worst of times. Now it is our time to value their work. Before I turn it over to the LCC, to fully explain the details of the contract, I want to highlight some important points. This is a bipartisan effort. I would like to thank Representatives Schumacher and Kresha for co-authoring the bill with me. Second, this is an open shop contract. Although all workers in the unit enjoy the benefits of the contract, no worker is required to join the union or pay dues or fair share dues. So I'll let the LCC, Ms. Weber from the LCC, explain the contract.
Thank you, Chair Nelson. And Ms. Weber, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I'm Michelle Weber with the Legislative Coordinating Commission, and we provide staff and administrative support to the Subcommittee on Employee Relations. As Representative Nelson mentioned, the contract provides several provisions that I'll talk through. I also wanted to mention that in your packets, there's a summary memo that provides some details about the agreement. Representative Nelson mentioned the wage changes that go into effect January 1st, 2024, or within 30 days, calendar days of federal approval of a state plan and waiver amendment. The minimum wage is increased from $15.25 an hour to $19 an hour. And then on January 1st, 2025, or within 30 days of federal approval, the minimum wage is increased to $20. It also creates a tiered wage structure for PCA Choice or CFSS on January 1st of 2025 or within 90 days of federal approval. That ranges from a minimum of $20 an hour up to $22.50 an hour, depending on the number of hours that a provider has worked since July 1st, 2017. It replaces two floating holidays by recognizing Independence Day and Veterans Day as paid holidays, and it also adds Juneteenth as a paid holiday. It creates an orientation committee that's intended to design orientation programming, and it dedicates $500,000 each year for the work of that committee. It also provides $3 million for stipends to individuals who have completed the orientation programming that's been designed. It permits the parties to create a joint labor management trust fund, with the state providing $1 million for future programs. It increases funds that are available for existing. There were previously $500 training stipends that were, and there was $1 million provided previously for that purpose. It increases that to $2 million. And it also includes a letter of agreement providing $1,000 stipends to providers who have achieved 6 months of service. And there's $50 million that's provided for those stipends. The overall costs of all of the provisions within the agreement are estimated to be $302.7 million in fiscal year 24-25 and $490.6 million in fiscal year 26-27. And Madam Chair, both MMB and DHS are available also if there are specific questions that members have that I'm not able to answer.
Thank you, Ms. Weber. We also have testimony. We have other testimony. Would you like to say something, Chair Nelson, before we call the...
No, we can bring the testifiers down.
Thank you very much. We have Tavana Johnson. Welcome, Ms. Johnson, to the committee. If you would please state your name for the record and begin your testimony.
My name is Tavana Johnson. Chair Clevarn and members of the committee, my name is Tavana Johnson, and I'm here to testify on behalf of my union, SEIU Healthcare Minnesota and Iowa. Our union represents over 50,000 healthcare workers across the state, including workers in hospitals, clinics, and nursing homes. I'm a part of the largest unit that covers almost 29,000 self-directed home care workers, including PCAs, and family caregivers. I provide care in the homes of members in my community in Austin, Minnesota. The work I do is incredibly important to me and most important to the people I care for. My work means that my clients can live in their own homes, live in the lives they choose. It saves the state thousands upon thousands of dollars because they are not in nursing homes or long-term care facilities. I maintain their homes by running their daily errands, which might include groceries, bankings, bill drop-off, and pharmaceutical pickups. I cook nutritious meals and make sure their homes are clean, safe environments. I also provide personal care such as bathing, dressing, and some clients might require me to even feed them amongst the many other duties that I perform. Home care has been facing a workforce crisis for a long time, and COVID only exacerbated that. Professional caregivers like myself have been expected to carry more and more every year as our disabled and elderly populations grow. And it's hard to find hope as the economy has changed and left us behind. It breaks my heart to know that so many people are going without care, so I find myself working as many hours as I possibly can manage just to ensure that as many people as possible in my community can receive services and get the care they desperately need. I'm incredibly proud of the tentative agreement we've reached with DHS and MMB. Our contract is a huge step towards serving this crisis. I want to thank Governor Walz and his administration for working with us and being a part of this historical opportunity. Our contract agreement includes a minimum wage increase from $15.25 to $20 over 2 years, a $1,000 bonus for those who have worked 6 months in the bargaining unit and help address the issue of retaining workers, a wage scale for experienced workers to keep people who have been doing this work the longest enjoy it in the field instead of leaving for better paying jobs with better benefits. Those experienced caregivers who invest in this work will finally see stepped increases up to $22.50 per hour. We also won the ability to shape an orientation program with DHS that will help professionalize this industry. I've cared for a substantial number of people in the decades I've dedicated to being a home care worker, and I've never once been given a thorough walkthrough of the expectations of the job, how to do it safely, best practices for communications with clients, or how to respond to potential emergencies I may face. It is time that we professionalize this work and give caregivers the support we need to do it well. This contract will change my life. With a $20 an hour wage, I can afford to solely support myself and do the work that I love and I feel that I have a God-given talent for. I also want to point out that this contract corrects an historic injustice. Home care work is disproportionately done by women and people of color. For that reason, this industry has been systematically excluded from basic labor protections. This has led to decades of low wages and underfunding. We must correct this, and this contract is a good start. To close, we are so incredibly grateful to be here talking about this historical life-changing agreement. This contract is truly life-changing for the people that do this work and the people that we care for. In the past, we have been able to do this work because of the bipartisan support we've had in legislature. I look forward to continuing that during this legislation session and many more ahead. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Johnson, and I'd just like to take this opportunity to thank you for your work, your compassion, and your professionalism. Thank you for being with us today.
Thank you.
Next, we would have Commissioner Showalter. Welcome back to the committee, Commissioner. If you'll state your name for the record and begin your testimony, please.
Absolutely. Thank you, Chair Cleburne. For the record, my name is Jim Showalter, Commissioner of Minnesota Management and Budget. And I just thank you for the opportunity to briefly testify in support of ratification of this contract with SEIU Healthcare of Minnesota. I also want to just extend the thanks to our team at MMB, Jen Klossman, who leads our labor relations team, Elise Bailey, partners at DHS, and Deputy Commissioner Aaron Campbell, who really oversaw this entire operation. I can report to you that the contract negotiated increases really address key issues for our workforce. And this is an important workforce because they provide services for elderly and disabled people throughout Minnesota. The high rates of vacancies for individual providers are a problem, and the wage floors that were negotiated help address some of these problems. The tiered structure of the pay help address some of these problems. The training and orientation address some of these problems, and additional holidays also all help to make sure that people who are already providing services stay in this workforce, and hopefully we can draw more people in to make sure that we can supply the services that you would expect and you appropriate and you ask us to deliver. The outcome is an important one. It's not just about the jobs, it's also about helping individuals stay independent and remain in the community. That's been a value of everyone through the years, and this contract helps support that objective. So we believe that these contract changes are essential tools to help us continue providing these services, and really appreciate the chance to work with SEIU Healthcare in a partnership and moving forward to provide services to Minnesotans. So appreciate your support and for this contract and the work that's being done.
Thank you, Commissioner, and I'd like to thank you and your team for helping get this bill across the finish line. We appreciate that. Is there any other individual wishing to testify from the public? Okay. I'm not aware of any other additional amendments. If it's all right with you, we can go to member questions. Chair Nelson. Okay. Members, any questions, concerns? No? Seeing none, I will, would you like closing comments?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And members, again, this is a contract that was negotiated between the union and the MMB, and the state, and covers not only the ones that are in the union, but they also the one that will send money to the other home care workers that work for agencies across the board. Again, we need to have these people so that people with disabilities, people, senior citizens can stay in their homes where it's cheaper to live, and it saves the money, the state money, by keeping those people in their homes and not in health care facilities. So thank you for your vote, and I hope you can all support this bill.
Thank you, Chair Nelson. And with that, I will renew my motion that House File 1695, as amended, be re-referred to Human Services Policy Committee. All those in favor of the motion, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Any opposed? Seeing none, the motion prevails, and House File 1695, as amended, is re-referred to Human Services Policy Committee. Thank you, Chair Nelson.
Thank you, members.
Our next bill up on the agenda is House File 413. Chair Stevenson. Welcome back to the committee, Chair Stevenson. It's good to have you with us. Since you were not a member of the committee, I'll move that House File 413 be re-referred to Climate and Energy Committee. We have the bill before us. Would you like to tell us about the bill?
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. House File 413 is a bill related to electric vehicles. It contains a number of provisions. I'll just briefly tell you the story of how this bill came to pass. A few years ago, the governor announced that he would be pursuing the clean cars rules. Shortly thereafter, I had lunch with Amber Backus from the auto dealers, and we talked about that. And she tried to convince me that the clean cars rule was a bad idea and should be not implemented. I tried to convince her it was a good idea and that it should be implemented, and we eventually grew to realize that we were not going to convince one another. And so the question became, could we find ways to work together to ease the transition that's occurring in Minnesota to electric vehicles? So this was an effort to find common ground on an issue where we disagreed. And so there's a number of provisions in here designed to smooth that transition, to be helpful to Minnesotans and to our auto dealers. Most of the bill is not within the scope of this committee's jurisdiction, but I'll just briefly touch on the pieces that are. There's a provision in here related to electric vehicle charging at the Capitol complex, refining some language that was enacted 2 years ago, I think now, or 1 year ago. And then there's also a strengthening of the existing preference in law that preferences electric vehicles and hybrids and other cleaner bearing vehicles ahead of conventional vehicles. And so with that, Madam Chair, I will turn over to any testifiers or questions from the committee.
We have listed one testifier, Carolyn Berninger. Welcome to the committee. If you'll state your name for the record and please begin your testimony.
Good morning, Chair Cleavorn and members of the committee. My name is Carolyn Berninger. I'm a public policy manager at the Great Plains Institute, testifying today on behalf of Drive Electric Minnesota. Drive Electric Minnesota is working to accelerate EV adoption in Minnesota and is made up of automakers and auto dealers, electric utilities and cooperatives, local and state government, corporations, and non-governmental organizations. We believe transportation electrification is a key strategy to reduce greenhouse gas emissions from the transportation sector, but Minnesota lags behind other states in EV adoption. This bill includes key strategies to address key challenges to increasing EV deployment in the state, including financial incentives that will reduce the upfront cost of EVs, promoting investments by Minnesota's electric utilities alongside continued private sector investment, and deploying EVs in the state fleet to move the needle towards meeting state electrification goals. Drive Electric Minnesota thanks Representative Stevenson for carrying this legislation and urges your support. Thank you.
Thank you very much. We appreciate your testimony. Chair Stevenson, I don't see any amendments to the bill. Is that correct?
I'm not aware of any.
Okay. First, then we will move. Is there anyone else in the public who wanted to testify in favor or in opposition to this bill? All right, seeing none, we'll move to member discussion. Okay, before we move to member discussion, I just want to state we have sections 1, 2, and 3 in our jurisdiction. That's my understanding. Is that your understanding?
Yes.
Stevenson? Okay. Representative Nash.
Madam Chair, was that for my benefit?
Just for the public, I think.
Okay. Well, Madam Chair and Chair Stevens, question. We just got the fiscal note, but it does talk about some of the assumptions that are made in the bill that there is an estimated cost for replacement of some of the equipment that's going on here. And the fiscal note says that the bill does not clearly define total life cycle costs and criterion will need to be developed or defined. And just a quick thought on that. If you're not able to define that, how can we appropriately figure out the cost for that? You know, in the fiscal note, it has a cost, but it's assuming that that is missing. So I'm just trying to figure out how we're going to appropriately tackle that, because I'm sure that the replacement costs are going to be profound.
I understand Ms. Bailey is here, who can address that question if you'd wish.
That's fine, but whatever you would like, Madam Chair. The only thing I would say in response to Representative Nash's question, you know, I like you, Representative Nash. I received the fiscal note this morning, and so I was just reviewing that myself. And I do think that that's a conversation that I'd like to have with the authors of the fiscal note. We have one more committee stop in the Energy Committee, and this is a question in the Energy Committee we very commonly discuss about life cycle costs, and so I think we will have a good conversation about that in the Energy Committee. I'm not sure I agree with the assertion that's made in the fiscal note that that's not a well-defined concept. And,
Madam Chair?
Representative Nash.
I do believe that portion is in our purview, I beat this drum regularly that we have either fiscal notes that come in late or they have things that raise questions for the jurisdiction of our committee. And this is clearly well within the purview of our committee. It's going to cost the state to replace these things. We don't have an understanding of what that will cost. And I'm a little concerned by this. So would like to know, do you intend to still move this out or what's the plan?
I would like to ask Ms. Bailey to come forward. I think there's a simple answer to this question, and I'd just like for you to have an opportunity to hear it as well. Mm-hmm. Thank you. If you'll state your name for the record and please proceed to answer the question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Julie Byrell. I'm the Legislative Director for the Department of Administration, and we manage the state's fleet. We are happy to work with Representative Stevenson on further developing the definition of the life cycle cost, or we could do that administratively at the Department of Administration as well.
Thank you very much. And I would just like the committee members to know that the statement that Representative Nash is referring to is on page 4 of the fiscal note. Chair Nash, or Chair, sorry about that.
Well,
Lead
I do,
Nash.
I do have a gavel in a subcommission, so that's, but, well, Madam Chair and members, once again, we're looking at things that are not particularly defined. And I'm sure that it can be done administratively. I'm sure of all those things, but this is the committee of jurisdiction for this, and we don't have a defined cost. And I will bet all the money in my wallet that this bill is going to be moved out. It's not going to be held over for inclusion. We've already made the referral to go to another committee, but it doesn't have a defined cost. So we have effectively an ellipsis that we're putting into the bill, saying, well, to be determined, we'll figure that out later. I just think that that's a very sloppy approach, particularly since I don't believe it's just going to be here at the Capitol complex. It also would be for charging stations at other state-owned facilities across the state, or is that just for the Capitol complex?
Chair Stevenson.
Madam Chair, Representative Nash. Well, to begin with, the language you're talking about is not relating to the charging stations. It's related to the state fleet purchase. Okay. The language in the bill, we're getting to the charging stations to answer your question, I believe is just the Capitol complex. And again, that's what we passed into law a couple years ago, and I think actually you were involved in that. And I think this is just tweaking some of the earlier language that you offered a couple years ago.
It was mostly based on Representative Garofalo,
but yeah. And I really strongly disagree with the idea that this is an ellipsis. The provision you're talking about says that the Department of Admin can deviate from this if the total life cycle cost is more than 10% higher than the next vehicle life in the preference order. That's not an ellipsis. We can have a discussion about what life cycle cost is, but there's no ellipsis in the bill. It's pretty clear. I also will note that the fiscal note has dollar amounts in it, and this bill also has appropriations in it that are not ellipses. So there are defined costs in the fiscal note, and there are defined appropriations in the bill. There's no ellipsis.
Further, I'd state on the fiscal note on that same page, it says that cost savings will also be realized in a number of ways through fuel, preventative maintenance, and repair costs as well. We have two more members with questions. Representative Nadeau.
Good morning, Madam Chair. Thank you. Thank you, Representative Stevenson. Can you walk me through? I kind of like this bill. I think that it's a bit vague in areas, and maybe that's by design. Can you walk me through your thoughts on when you designed Section 2 of this bill, and how you established the hierarchy of, you know, knowing that there's a lot dependent on if all of a sudden, you know, MnDOT decides to replace 100% of its vehicles with electric, let's just EVs. That there's a lot of things that they have to consider. Do they have the ability to generate enough electricity to charge at the frequencies that they need? Can you just walk me through your thoughts on how you developed that criteria in Section 2, knowing that the technology is going to change? And can you just walk me through that? And also, can you think about it from a county standpoint as well, if you will, because I think this is going to kind of lead the thinking in many other political subdivisions across the state if the state passes this law.
Thank you, Chair Stevenson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Nadeau. It may lead. You're right. It may lead. I just want to note that, and I think you weren't saying this, that this only applies to the state. I mean, counties or local units governments may choose to do something similar, but that would be their choice. The bill doesn't require that. The thinking here, again, I mean, this started with the conversation with Ms. Backus from the dealers, and one of the comments I recall her making was, well, if we're going to have this clean car rules with all these clean cars, then the state should be a good customer of ours. And, like, the state should be buying electric vehicles when it is practical and possible. If we're going to try and encourage their adoption, we should try and follow that same rule. And I agreed with that. And so that's the genesis of this portion of the bill. If we're going to encourage the market to have electric vehicles and encourage people to sell them, we can help by buying them whenever possible. And so we have a criteria here recognizing that electric vehicles, while often the best solution, more often than not, I would argue, there are specific occurrences where maybe it isn't the best option. And there's a number of ways that that might be. We were just talking about if the life cycle cost is more for a particular application, or there might be a situation where it's not feasible for the particular task if you have to drive the vehicle very long distance in very rural parts of the state. You might not be able to use an electric vehicle for that application. And so we try to account for that in developing it. I'm not sure if that answers your question about walking through my thought process, but that's kind of where we came from.
Representative Nadeau.
And thank you. And it does. My thing is just to ensure that we don't become too rigid. And I feel like that's the intent. But I worry, I guess, that if all of a sudden we have some fleet manager that decides, you know, I'm really all about diesel, for example, and they're going to always make the argument that, you know what, it's never going to be appropriate because we're in Otter Tail County, and I'm sorry, Otter Tail County, I'm just using that as an example. You know, we're never ever going to implement, you know, our county's too big. And so I'm just, and I'm not saying that that's going to happen. I think the language is open, and so that's why I was just asking. And the same thing would hold true if all of a sudden, you know, some fleet manager says, you know what, we're not going to buy another grader that uses diesel fuel because we're going to wait until the EV technology is out there for a grader. Or, you know what, we're going to do all EV, but we don't have enough energy. I mean, we can't produce enough energy, you know. So that's my thing. That's my worry in this. And I know I'm kind of going out there and far afield, and you know, on the margins of this thing, but that's the only thing that I'm wondering about is that we have to trust these fleet managers to make these decisions, and hopefully there's not regulations or rules that come in later that say, you know what, we're going to push this faster than we can withstand it. Mm-hmm. From a tax standpoint, from an energy production standpoint, and I just want to make sure that we don't have activists on either side, you know, trying to push this thing in the wrong direction. So I think it's a pretty good effort to try to move this forward. I do. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Doe. Representative Bonner.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you to Representative Stevenson for bringing this forward. I did want to actually point out, and I'm sure we may have a testifier that can back this up, certainly, but just did a quick look, and there is a 2021 study from the U.S. Department of Energy. It compared various sizes of electric vehicles to their gas counterparts to really understand the total cost of ownership. And what they found, that the total cost of ownership over a 10 to 15 year life cycle was actually quite similar, with one notable exception, maintenance. And which is, of course, when we're talking about our fleet, is very, very important. And what they found is that electric vehicles, on average, cost about 0.07 cents per mile versus 0.10 per mile for a gas-powered engine. So I think that when we talk about vehicles that will need to be replaced, maintenance is certainly a key factor in that. We also know that overall the purchase price of electric vehicles has been going down precipitously over the last few years as we've had more enter the market. And the one complication for electric vehicles that we've had in the past is battery life. The average battery life at this current point in time is about 10 years, and those batteries are getting better and better with each passing year because the technology is evolving so quickly. So, you know, I think this is a sound bill. I certainly also appreciate the last testimony that the author gave about the idea of making sure that we're being thoughtful about what's practical and makes sense, where sometimes electric vehicles may not make sense for the state, but certainly saying where it does make sense, where it is an option, where we can save money on maintenance, it makes sense to do so. So I appreciate the bill and just wanted to contribute that additional information. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Bonner. Representative Joy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Stevenson, just clarification so I can understand this bill too. One of the things in there says requires public utilities to file a plan with the Minnesota Public Utility Commission. So again, the town I live in, Holly, we have a PUC, a public utility. So that public utilities have to file a plan every 3 years because their state, and the only reason I'm asking is there is a state vehicle that lives in town. One of the people that work for the state drives, and I'm curious, will we have to file a plan, or does this, just because it says requires public utilities to file a plan with Minnesota Public Utilities, will they not have to? I mean, it's just clarification for me.
Thank you. Chair Stevenson.
Yeah, so that's in a different provision in the bill, and I'm just scanning to it. But the public utilities that are discussed here are defined in a different area of law. That's the independent or investor-owned utilities. Okay. Public utility, as used in this section of law, are the investor-owned utilities. So it would be Xcel, Minnesota Power, and Otter Tail. It would not be your local municipal or co-op.
Okay, thank you. Nope.
Thank you for that clarification. Next, we have Representative Kosnick.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Stevenson. Get your name right this time. can you just clarify a little bit the Subdivision 9 on the charging electric service fee on the Capital Area, and then with the repealing in Section 9 of your bill? I think it's just clarification, but as the author of the part that's being repealed, if you could just kind of clarify what the purpose or intention is on that for me.
Thank you, Representative Kosnick. Chair Stevenson.
Madam Chair, Representative Kosnick. So this bill from the beginning has always included a provision to require the charging at the Capitol complex. That particular provision, though, made it into law in the state government finance bill a couple years ago. In the time since, admin has had some difficulty administering that. The way the language was written results in a fee that is much higher than how much it really costs to charge an electric vehicle. So I think the fee right now, it's in the fiscal note, is north of $50 a month, which that's not, I mean, I own an electric vehicle, I charge it at my house, that's not anywhere close to how much it costs. Even if you used it every day, you wouldn't be doing that. So this is a refinement that's meant to keep the spirit of the original idea that, you know, let's pay for the electricity we're using here, but giving admin the flexibility to do it in a way that actually is economical.
Chair Stevenson, I just want to clarify the statement you just made. You were saying that the fee charged is currently excessive. Is that what I'm hearing? Thank you.
Yeah.
I just want to make sure that's clear.
It's not consistent. The goal of the amendment was to have people paying for their own electricity when they're charging here, which I 100% agree with. The way that we wrote the language 2 years ago, the fee is much higher than what that would have been.
Thank you for that clarification.
Madam Chair and
Representative Kosnick.
Representative Stevens, I appreciate you working on that. I think the difference is that the state is incurring a lot of cost to put in the charging stations. And the way the original language was built was work with the Department of Administration and helped cover the cost of installing those stations. So you may consider it excessive, but it's an actual cost to the state. And so a little concern there, but I'm sure you can work that out in your future stops.
Thank you, Representative Kosnick. The cost of roads is thankfully not shared 100%. By the individual as well. So, Lead Nash, I cut you off a little earlier, so if you want to wrap up, that would be great.
Yeah. Well, thank you, Madam Chair. I'll just note to Chair Stevenson, this doesn't include electric mowers at all, does it? Just making sure.
Yeah, Chair Stevenson.
It does not.
Okay, because that would be horrible to have an electric mower. But Madam Chair and members, you know, I know that electric vehicles are becoming more prevalent. I have seen some studies and some side-by-side bake-offs of gasoline-powered or diesel-powered versus electric. And I do think that there may be some use cases in the metro or short term, but as it relates to stuff that's out state and is a long distance from a charging station, I think that we really have to make sure that there is a balance. I understand that we're going to be looking at these vehicles, but I really do hope, and this is not part of the bill, but just as a statement in general, that we look at recognizing that a state-owned vehicle, perhaps that's going to be driving from St. Paul to Hibbing, an electric vehicle is not an appropriate use case for that, just because it can't make it, I think, as the chair referenced. So I hope that we just don't rush towards all electrical vehicles in the fleet, because I don't think that makes sense long term. But I do have some concerns about this. I do have concerns about it not being appropriately defined on some of the things that are in the fiscal note. I know that that's not going to be compelling enough to the chair to not move this out. So I guess with that, I will encourage members to vote no, but I don't think that matters because the chair is giving me the it doesn't matter grant. So thank you.
Lead Nash, you seem to think you spend a lot of time in my head knowing what I think. That's always a dangerous proposition, but I appreciate the fact that we may differ in opinion at times, but we can still joke and humor with each other. Chair Stevenson, is there any wrap-up that you would like to have on
that? I'll just close with an amusing story that I think relates to the life cycle cost that conversation that we're having. I purchased an electric vehicle about 4 years ago now. It's a Nissan Leaf, not one of the fancy. I'm not one of the Teslas that you see out in the garage there. I've got a used Nissan Leaf, and I really like it. It's a great car. I'm not really a car guy. I'm not the guy tinkering on his car or working on his car. I don't really, that's fine. If that's your thing, it's not my thing. Earlier this year, just a few months ago, I was trying to get out of my driveway. My driveway has a hill that comes towards the house, and I was trying to get out one morning. I was kind of struggling. It was an icy day, and I thought, oh boy, I need to go I need to think about snow tires for this car. I've never had this problem before over 4 years, but I don't know, this winter seems very snowy. I better go take snow tires. So I go to the Firestone, where I usually have gone for my cars, to the local place, and I say, hey, I think I need snow tires. And they say, well, what kind of tires do you have in your car now? I said, I don't know. So we go out to the car, and looking at the tires, I went out and looked at them, I saw the problem. These tires were totally bald. I mean, they were just smooth, completely smooth. Now, how did that happen? That happened because the way that I have always replaced tires for every gasoline powered car I've ever had is I go in to get my oil changed or some other piece of maintenance, and they say, hey, you need to replace your tires, okay? In the 4 years I've had this EV, I've never taken it to a mechanic ever before. I mean, you don't change oil. There's no oil in the car, and nothing on it has ever broken in the 4 years I had the car. So there was no, you know, my rhythm of tire buying was when I take it in for the maintenance that I have to do, someone tells me, boy, you got to change your tires. That never happened, and so my tires got to the point that they were I should not have been driving on them, and I will be more observant in the future. But that is a testament, and I'm not the only electric vehicle owner that I know who has had a similar experience of saying, boy, I go a really long time without needing any maintenance on these cars. They're good cars. They'll be good for the state. I'd ask for a yes vote.
Thank you, Chair Stevenson. And with that, I will renew my motion that House File 413 be re-referred to the Climate and Energy Committee. All those in favor of the motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, say nay.
No.
And with that, the motion prevails, and House File 413 is re-referred to the Climate and Energy Committee. Representative Aitken, welcome to the committee. I think I'm calling everyone chair today. So welcome, Chair Aitken.
Thank you.
Since you are not a member of this committee, I will move that House File 390 be re-referred to the Health Committee. The bill is now before us. If you would like to speak to us about your bill.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members. House File 390 is a patient-focused bill that is designed to ensure complete breast cancer screening that promotes early diagnosis and ultimately saves lives. Here's what we know. 1 in 8 women will be diagnosed with breast cancer at some point in their lives, and in fact, it's the most common form of cancer in women. We also know that breast cancer is not limited to just women, and that many men are diagnosed as well. Treatment and survival rates for breast cancer have advanced over the last many years and decades, and it's reflective, and in large part it's due to the early diagnosis. The importance of early diagnosis and detection is reflected in the requirements by the Affordable Care Act to include breast cancer screening as an essential health benefit at no cost to patients. The goal of this federal provision is to increase early detection, lower cancer treatment cost, and ultimately save lives. The only problem is that for a small percentage of patients, an initial mammogram is inconclusive. It doesn't say that there is a problem, and it doesn't say that there isn't. Those patients need additional testing to determine if they need to be concerned or not. Those tests can, and often do, come with large co-pays to patients that can range from several hundred dollars up to $1,000. And these co-pays become a barrier to care and potentially delay diagnosis, which we know can negatively impact survival rates of breast cancer. In fact, treating advanced cancer is often much more expensive, coupled with reduced rates of survival. As a breast cancer survivor myself, I know firsthand how important early diagnosis is, and I want to ensure that all patients have the opportunity for the positive outcomes that I experienced. I want to point out that this bill has been introduced several times over the last many years and went through the Department of Commerce analysis to determine that it is not, in fact, a new mandate, that it is a clarification of existing benefits. With that, I do have a testifier that's here. There was another testifier that was going to be here, a social worker with Gilda's Club, but she is sick. Her testimony was really to state that she's been able to see firsthand how important that early detection is, and unfortunately, the disproportionate impacts on communities of color that often result from delayed diagnosis.
Thank you, Chair Akam, and welcome Amy Koch to the committee. It's good to see you with us. If you please state your name for the record and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Amy Koch, and I'm here to testify on behalf of Susan G. Komen in support of House File 390. When my Aunt Laura was staying with her grandmother, my great-grandmother, she tells a story that she noticed one morning while they were getting dressed that her grandmother had deep scars across her chest. And as a kid does, she asked her grandmother, "Grandma, what are those for?" And her grandmother said, "Those are so I get to spend more time with you." What my great-grandmother did not know is how deep those scars really would go, because the same scars were on her daughter, my grandmother, when she passed away from breast cancer. The scars followed her granddaughter, my mother, when she passed away from breast cancer at 64. And those scars are on her great-granddaughter, my sister, who has already been diagnosed and treated with a double mastectomy for breast cancer. An estimated 16% of women screened with modern digital mammography will require follow-up imaging. House File 390 ensures that those women will have the required diagnostic screening covered. Family history, anomalies, dense breast tissue, or a previous bout with breast cancer are all reasons why you might need a deeper diagnostic. The Department of Commerce, as Representative Akam, evaluated the language in the bill and stated very clearly that this is not a new mandate, but a benefit under the ACA, and as the bill clarifies existing benefits under the health plans. 2 years ago, I had an abnormal screening, initial screening, which was my second. My family history and body makeup required diagnostic screening. After the ultrasound, I received a bill for over $800, and I called my insurance company thinking something was wrongfully billed because screening is covered. To my surprise, I was told that I only get the initial mammogram. Now, this was a surprise, an annoyance, and expensive for me, but for many women, as you would have heard from Shaniqua, they may not be able to afford the additional expense, and they may forego this important screening. I have seen the costs and devastation associated with misdetection up close and very personal. The tens of thousands of dollars spent on my mom's double mastectomy and the round of chemo and radiation that followed, Thousands more were spent on the second round when the cancer had moved to her lymph nodes. Still more thousands of dollars spent on the brain scans for the headache and that appointment where the doctor said to me, "Your mom's brain is full of cancer." The money that was spent on the hospice nurses, the bed, the equipment, the every other day delivery of pain medication because mom couldn't speak at that point, and I had to make sure that she had enough medicine to ensure that she didn't suffer. But early detection saves those medical costs. Early detection saves that pain, and early detection will save lives. My sister Natasha was able to catch hers very early. She had a preventative double mastectomy, and we fully expect her to spend a very good long time with us. So I would ask that members support House File 390 and help people spend more time with the ones that they love.
Thank you, Amy Cook, for your testimony today. I'm not aware of any amendments to the bill.
No.
Okay. Would you like for us to move into member discussion now, or do you
have? That'd be great.
All right. Members, any questions, concerns? Representative Bonner.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Patty, for bringing this forward. And you know, because you've heard me testify to this bill before, but, you know, I think I really appreciate the testifier as well because, you know, every woman secretly has this fear in the back of their mind. Literally every woman. We all think about it at some level. We do our monthly breast exams, the ones in the shower. My mom's a nurse. She used to tell me how to do this. But you don't think of, you try to suppress it in the back of your mind until within the last year, I had a scare of my own. And, you know, going in, I typically have dense tissue. They found three areas on my scan of concern. And I remember very distinctly getting the call and the instant note of fear in that call. And they said, "We need you to get in here as soon as humanly possible to have this scan." And I remember thinking, "Oh my God, what is this going to cost? Do I have cancer? What is this going to mean?" And it was really quite frightening. I have a family history. One of my great aunts had to have both her breasts removed when diagnostics were not very good. They didn't want to take the chance. I have a cousin right now with cancer that has now spread into her lymph nodes and is continuing to grow. And so the fear was compounded. But, you know, I think the good news about that follow-up is that I am one of the fortunate ones. We found that the three items that in question are under observation, and we do not believe that they are cancerous. But I also remember a huge sense of relief as one of the first things that the technician said to me. She had looked at my insurance ahead of time, and she said to me, "I just want you to know that this follow-up visit is covered." And I remember sadly sitting in the seat thinking, "Oh, my God. Thank the Lord. This is incredible." But I also remember in that same thought thinking about the folks for whom it is not covered and what that means and how many people might not take that follow-up visit because they don't know what the bill is going to look like. So I'm really grateful for this bill. I think it is a really good way to put prevention in first and foremost. And I want to say, you know, the fiscal note, it doesn't cover the cost of hope. It doesn't cover the cost of the savings of all of the pain and the anguish that is saved, all the medical costs that are saved by catching things early. So I'm really grateful for this bill, and thank you for bringing it forward.
Thank you, Representative Bonner. Representative Nadeau.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative. We heard this in health, and I was supportive of it then. I'm supportive now. It's the one, and we didn't see have a fiscal note. And when it was in health committee. So I didn't see the cost of this. But I wanted to say, as I was reading through the fiscal note, what came to my mind is, you know, we as people in CGIP or people in, you know, with their health plans, I mean, we recognize and understand that we pay for preventative services. And this is one of those things that takes it a step further. And I think it's an important step further. And I think we should continue to find those areas where we need to make sure that we can do that in a reasonable way. But actually, you know, but also balancing that with with the cost. And there are costs associated with these things. And I think there is a bit of ambiguity. Thank you. in how far do we take this? And you know, and I also noticed in the packet that you know there was a, you know, here there's a letter of support from a radiologist. You know, and I just want to put out that radiology. I mean, if we want to control the cost of diagnostics, maybe we figure out how radiologists can do their jobs a little cheaper. This is one of the most expensive components of healthcare, and maybe we can get them to come to the table and help us lower the cost of healthcare in this as well. So thank you for bringing the bill.
Chair Aikum, and I would like to just remind my side of the table that when we address you, we always address you by chair or representative. So please.
Patty is perfect, so thank you, Madam Chair.
Not in committee.
And Representative, I thank you for the comments, and I just wanted to also say that while the fiscal note, I do think it was in the Health Committee, but it maybe it wasn't, but I think it was. And just want to say that in the fiscal note, it talks about the costs of providing these services, but what it doesn't reflect is the potential cost savings of early diagnosis. And so I think it's kind of only one side of the equation that's reflective here. So I appreciate your comments very much. Thank you.
Thank you. And I believe your testifier would like to make a comment as well. Yes.
Madam Chair,
your name for the
representative, thank you for the, you also had mentioned that kind of where do we stop on this? And I just want to point out, because there's a difference when it comes to breast cancer diagnosis from other cancers because of the nature of, I mean, frankly, breasts are tricky. So if you have dense breast tissue, which makes you more, we're not even sure why, but you're more prone to having breast cancer. But dense breast tissue shows up differently on the initial screening. Breast tissue shows up white. Fatty tissue shows up dark. So black. So if you have dense breast tissue like I do, that shows up white. And unfortunately, on a screen, the other thing that shows up white are tumors. And so distinguishing in that initial screening is incredibly difficult, and it really requires follow-up. So that's why this is deemed, I think that's part of why this is deemed a clarification and why that follow-up is so important.
Thank you, Ms. Koch. Next, we have a Representative Harder.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Acorn. My question is, I just need some clarification. So on the page 2 of the bill, there's a whole list of exceptions. Can you tell me where does the list come from? Is that from the Affordable Care Act, or I'm just curious where that list came from. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Carter. Chair Acorn.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for the question. So page 2, are you looking at line 2.1?
Representative
Harder.
Thank you.
Looking at the bill.
It lists a number of exceptions to the co-payments shall be subject to the following exceptions.
Could you 2.2? Sorry.
I'm sorry, 2.2 in the bill. And so I'm just curious where the list came from.
For the public, that would be lines 2.4 through 2.18.
I think I'm looking at a different printing of the bill, because that's not where it is. Well,
we are bringing you copy.
Can I phone a friend? Thank you. So these are parts, and maybe we can ask House Research to respond to this. These are not parts of the bill. This is part of I believe those statutes come out of the public program, so Medicare and Medicaid. So those are not part of this bill, but maybe House Research can.
The new language in the bill is underscored, and the other is existing law.
Right.
Mr. Gehring.
Madam Chair, Representative Harder, I'm not sure that I have much more to add beyond that, but much of what you see in Section 3 is the current law, as Chair Cleburne stated, and the new language is a new exception on line 2.28 and 2.29. And this is a list of exceptions that apply to copays and deductibles for health services, but I'm not a health policy expert, so I don't know that I want to say exactly where they come from.
Thank you, Mr. Gehring. Representative Harder.
Thank you. No further questions. I was just curious about that. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Representative Kosnick.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you to the author for bringing this bill forward. I will be supporting it and asked to be a co-author on it. But I do want to reemphasize Representative Nadeau's point that this was apparently already heard in the Health Committee, but perhaps without a fiscal note. And the fiscal note, you're shaking your head. I don't know. My point is if it wasn't there, he brings up a good point that maybe there's a way to lower the cost of this, and that is why we should take a look at fiscal notes, and if it comes to a finance committee, it should be discussed there, and whether you could improve your bill even better, that would even garner more support. But the intent of the bill I do support, and I think it's also important to pay attention to the cost, and if there's a way to drive down the cost, that certainly should be something that we strive for.
Thank you. And Representative Kosnick, I have seen a fiscal note in another committee where this bill was heard.
Commerce.
And this one does say revised, so it's an updated fiscal note. Would you like to say anything more about that?
I would be I'll go back and look at the agenda for the Health Committee when it was heard, and I'm almost positive. I'm not going to say 100% positive, but I'm almost positive it was there. But I appreciate the comments, and I do take it to heart.
Okay. And then Representative Kosnick, that was all for you. Is that correct?
Yeah, thank you.
And Representative Nadeau, one last word for you.
And I just wanted to apologize if I missed it in Health Committee and it caused a problem here. I didn't mean to do that at all. So I'm sorry to create any confusion.
Lead Nash.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Madam Chair. We all have someone that is in our life that has been affected by breast cancer. So I think that this is a good bill to support, and I'll be supporting it and encourage my members to do so as well.
Thank you. Any closing comments? Chair Akam?
No, just thank you to the committee. Thank you for the support on both sides of the table. And it's going back to health, so health will have an opportunity to evaluate it with the fiscal note if it did not the first time. So.
Right. And with that, I will renew my motion that House File 390 be re-referred to the Health Committee. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed? Hearing none, the motion prevails, and House File 390 is re-referred to the Health Committee. I have the next bill, so I'll trade places with Vice Chair Hewitt. I'll go to the testifying table.
Chair Cleborn, I believe you have a bill, House File 2033, for consideration.
That's correct, Chair Hewitt.
Please.
And I'd like to move that the House File 2033 be before the committee to be re-referred to the Ways and Means Committee.
We have your bill before us, Chair. Please tell us about your bill.
Thank you. The House File 2033 is an appropriation bill for $196,000 in this fiscal year, 2023, to be appropriated from the general fund to the Office of Administrative Hearings. The Office of Administrative Hearings is one of the three courts located within the executive branch. The Office of Administrative Hearings has broad jurisdiction that includes fair campaign practice complaints and certain data practice matters. OAH receives a small appropriation from the general fund to maintain hearings in these two areas. The appropriation in fiscal year 2023 was $137,000. As we will hear from the Chief Administrative Law Judge, Jenny Starr, because there have been a significant increase in case filings, the appropriation was fully expended within the first quarter of the current fiscal year. This bill provides $196,000 from the general fund to help the Office of Administrative Hearings maintain fair, timely, and impartial hearings in campaign and data practice matters. And with that, I would ask that we please go to our testifiers.
Thank you, Chair Cleborn. And I believe you have two. So, Judge Starr, if you could state your name for the record and start with your testimony.
Chair, members of the committee, thank you so much for having me. I'm Jenny Starr. I'm the Chief Administrative Law Judge at the Office of Administrative Hearings. So on a fiscal year basis, the Office of Administrative Hearings generally receives about 25 newly filed cases under chapters 211B, Fair Campaign Practices, 211A, Finance Acts, and 13, Data Practices. And we generally expend around 600 hours of time from our judges and attorneys on those cases. To date, in fiscal year 23, we've received over 80 newly filed cases. And we've expended already over 1,400 hours of our time. We anticipate receiving about 100 newly filed cases this fiscal year and reaching around 2,000 hours of time. Now, the increase in case filings and our time is relatively proportional, which tells us that the cases we're receiving aren't significantly more or less complex than in prior fiscal years. We've also looked at the rate of dismissal at the prima facie or probable cause phases, and the rate of dismissal is consistent with past years. So in past years, about 45% of cases have been dismissed at those early stages of review, and this fiscal year we're seeing around 40%. So what this tells us is that we're not seeing an increase in cases that you might consider to be frivolous or without merit. We haven't seen any pattern in a specific subdivision of those chapters for which cases are being brought. And I share all of this with you just to express that the increase is simply volume from our perspective. We hear each of these cases on its own merits in a fair, timely, and independent, impartial manner. It is a duty, a statutory obligation of our court to hear these cases, and I'd ask for your support in the deficiency funding for this fiscal year.
Thank you, Judge Starr. If you could stay around, there may be questions, and I believe we have one more person testifying, sorry.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair, my name is Rich Neumeister. When I saw this article or the bill, I wanted to make my comments known because it involves something called the Minnesota Government Data Practices Act. 13.085 in the law was done 12 years ago bipartisanly, where people who go to government and ask for data and are told by government, rather than go to court, this was a process where it can be done. And I just want to share with you some points about that. OAH is important since it's easier for individual data requesters to seek compliance through it. It has more streamlined rules and is less cumbersome than district court proceedings, the other option for seeking compliance to the Data Practices Act. OAH has a good track record of high-quality data practices decisions, including data issues right that other than district courts got wrong. For instance, the question of whether government data stored electronically by a third party was accessible under the Data Practices Act was resolved correctly in Walmart versus Anoka using the OAH decision, while a Ramsey County judge got it all wrong. OAH is much faster from a procedural standpoint than district court. Now, because a lot of reps and senators know that I'm affiliated with that law, I do get lots of questions and inquiries. So one of the questions was asked, Rich, why do you see this increase at OAH? So I just said generally because of the times, because more people are making requests for body camera data, for COVID-related things, whatever it might be. But I spoke with the chief judge today, and I asked why the high rate. Well, a lot of it is because of Fair Campaign. So I think that's important to share with you. Yes, it's not all data practices, but a large of it is because of the past election year, why the increase is a fair amount of it with the Fair Campaign things. So I just wanted to share that perspective. This is an important tool for the public. There needs to be some reforms with the caps, like what the fees are and all that, but that's another story. So, thank Mr. You, Chairman, members of the committee, I want to thank you very much for the few moments of your time.
Thank you for your testimony.
And I support the appropriation.
If you could stay close, there might be questions. Chair Cleborn, would you like to go to member questions?
Please, thank
you. Oh, wait, one more second. Are there anybody, as a public hearing, is there anybody else in the audience that would like to testify for the bill or against it? Seeing nobody standing up, we're going to go to member questions.
Thank you.
Members. Representative Nash.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, this is a good appropriation. This is something that we all can support. It's something that I believe that OAH is, if we were to compare them to a baseball umpire, has a very consistent strike zone, and has never, in my understanding, had an accusation of capriciousness or falling heavily handed on one side of an issue or another. So I think this is something that we can support.
Thank you, Representative Nash. And I don't think we have a pitching clock with this division. So Representative Nadeau.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have two questions. And thank you, Representative Cleghorn. Does this appropriation go to the base moving forward? Is this just a one-time fund?
I'm sorry, Madam Chair.
Chair, Representative, yes, this is a one-time appropriation to manage the deficiency in the current fiscal year.
Thank you.
Representative Ndo?
Yep. What is the plan moving forward then you just think this is a blip in the cycle, or is there a plan moving forward to be, I was looking at the funding share, most of the money comes from workers' compensation special compensation fund. I mean, is that increasing this year? Are we looking at capturing more of those revenues to fully fund your department moving forward or not?
Madam Chair, we're going to bring in research on this, if that's okay. Ms. Roberts?
Mr. Chair, member, in regards to the question of whether this is one time or not, because the appropriation is made in the second year of the biennium, unless we add language that says this is a one-time appropriation, it would carry forward into the base.
Madam Chair.
Thank you for that clarification, Ms. Roberts.
Representative Nadeau, are you good?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My second question was, and I appreciate that clarity. Thank you. Are we going to remedy that so that it does continue to be part of the base? Are we going to amend it so that it is only one time? But I'm looking at more sustainably moving forward. How do we make sure that we fund this organization so we don't have to come back and ask for one-time dollars? That's my overall question.
Madam Chair, I believe this is going to Ways and Means next. You could possibly look at that before we go there. Is that correct?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And frankly, the request that the office has asked for is less than I suggested. This is the second time they've had to come forward for a deficiency appropriation. I believe that they have, based on the caseload that's coming in, it may be that this is the new normal. And we do have time as we look at their overall budget that will be in our budget bill that we can make adjustments at that time. Thank you.
And Madam Chair, that's when the office met with me. I felt the same way. I thought this was a very mild or meek ask. So with the work that you've been asked to do in that office, I was just overwhelmed by seeing what your ask was. So thank you for being fiscally responsible. Are there any other questions from the membership here? Hearing none. Closing, Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. It's a good bill. It's an important appropriation. This is about timely due process for the Minnesotans, and I ask for your support. And with that, may I renew my motion? I renew my motion that House File 2033 be referred to Ways and Means.
Members, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? The ayes have it. You're on your way to Ways and Means.
Thank you very much.
Do you want me to close the committee out?
Please do.
And members, thank you for your great work today. It looks like we got a few minutes to get over to the floor. So with that said, I think our next meeting is right there, March 2nd at 8:30. Thank you. This meeting's adjourned.